Side 9. The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 309. He peered up over the edge of a forward bale. There was no visible enemy, but the doors of the warehouse had been shut. Gloom flew across the warehouse in a sudden wave. Beyond the glazed vaulting of the ceiling, it had grown swiftly and astonishingly dark, as if the stink had thickened further.
"Should we make a run for it?" whispered Tom.
"Not without Brian," Mallory said. Fraser shook his head dourly, not speaking his doubt, but it was clear enough. They worked in the gloom for a while, clearing space, digging in deeper, heaving up some of the bales to serve as crenellations. At the sound of their activity, more shots came, muzzle flashes savagely lighting the darkness, bullets screaming off iron braces overhead. Here and there in the heaps of merchandise, the kindled light of lanterns glowed. More shouted orders, and the firing ceased. There was a flurry of pattering on the metal roof, swiftly gone.
"What was that?" Tom asked.
"Sounded like rats scampering," Mallory said.
"Rain,"
Fraser suggested. Mallory said nothing. Another ash fall seemed far more likely. The gloom lightened again, quite suddenly. Mallory peered over the edge. A crowd of the rascals were creeping forward, almost to the foot of the ramparts, barefoot and in hushed silence, some with knives in their teeth. Mallory bellowed in alarm and began firing. He was blinded at once by his own muzzle flashes, but the Ballister Molina, kicking and pumping, seemed to have a life of its own. In an instant, the three remaining rounds were gone. Not wasted, though. At such short range, he had not been able to miss. Two men were down, a third crawling, and the rest fleeing in terror. Mallory could hear them regrouping out of sight, milling, cursing each other. Mallory, his gun empty, grasped its hot barrel like a club. The building shook with the awful roar of Brian's pistol. The silence afterward was broken by agonized screams. A long and harrowing minute passed then, filled with infernal yells from the wounded and dying, with a crashing, a cursing, and clattering. Suddenly, a dark form came catapulting into their midst, stinking of gunpowder. Brian.
"Good job you didn't shoot me," he said. "Damn me, it's dark in here, ain't it?"
"Are ye all right, lad?" Mallory said. "Nix," Brian said, getting to his feet. "Look what I brought ye, Ned." He passed the thing into Mallory's hands. The smooth, heavy form of stock and barrel fit Mallory's grip like silk. It was a buffalo rifle. "They've a whole crate of such beauties," Brian said, "out in a poky little office across the way, and munitions with it, though I could only carry two boxes." Mallory began loading the rifle at once, round after brassy round, clicking into the spring loader with a ticking like fine clockwork. "Queer business," Brian said. "Don't think they knew I was loose among them. No proper sense of strategy. Don't seem to be any army traitors among this rabble, I'll tell you that." "That Barker of yours is a marvel, lad," Fraser said. Brian grunted. "Not any more, Mr. Fraser. I'd only two rounds. Wish I'd held back. But when I saw that lovely chance for enfilading fire, I'd got to take it." "Never you mind," Mallory told him, caressing the rifle's walnut stock. "If we'd four of these, we could hold 'em back all week." "My apologies," Brian said, "but I won't be doing much more of a proper reconnaissance in force. They winged me a bit." A stray bullet had seared across the front of Brian's shin. White bone showed in the shallow wound, and his filth-caked boot was full of blood. Fraser and Tom wadded clean cotton against the wound, while Mallory kept watch with the rifle.
"Enough," Brian protested at last. "You fellows carry on to beat Lady Nightingale. Do you see anything, Ned?"
"No," Mallory said. "I hear them plotting mischief, though." "They're back in three mustering grounds," Brian said. "They had a rally point just out of your line of fire, but I raked 'em there with the Tsar's slag shot. I doubt they'll rush us again. They've not got the nerve for it now."
"What will they do, then?"
"Some sort of sapper's work, I'd wager," Brian said. "Advancing barricades, perhaps something on wheels." He spat dryly. "Damn me, I need a drink.
I haven't been this dry since Lucknow.
Sorry, Mallory said.
Brian sighed. We had a very pucker water boy with the regiment in India. That bleeding little Hindu was worth any 10 of these buggers.
Did you see the woman? Fraser asked him. Or Captain Swing?
No, Brian said. I was staying to cover, creeping about, looking for a better class of firearm mostly, something with a range. Queer things I saw, too. Found Ned's game rifle in a little office room, not a soul in it but a little clerky chap writing at a desk, pair of candles burning, papers all scattered about, full of crated guns for export. And why they're keeping those fine rifles back with some clerk and passing out Victorias is beyond my professional understanding.
A wave of drowned and greenish light passed into the building, outlining, as it passed, an armed man rising up a pulley line, seated in a noose. Swift as thought, Mallory centered his bead on the man, exhaled, fired. The man flopped backward, dangled from his knees, hung limp. Rifle fire began to smack into the cotton. Mallory ducked down again.
"Fine emplacements, cotton bales," said Brian with satisfaction, patting the burlapped floor. "Hickory Jackson hid behind him in New Orleans and gave us a toweling, too."
"What happened in the office room, Brian?" Tom asked.
"Fellow rolled himself a sort of papirosi," Brian said. "Know those? Turkish baccy wraps. Except the bugger took an eyedropper from a little medical vial, dribbled it about on the paper first, then wrapped some queer leaf from a candy jar. I'd a proper look at his face when he lit his smoke from the candle, and he'd a very absent look. Deluded, you might say. Rather like Brother Ned here, with one of his scholarly problems."
Brian laughed dryly, meaning no harm. "Scarcely seemed right to disturb his fancy then, so I took a rifle and a box or two real quiet-like and left."
Tom laughed. "You'd a good look, eh?" Mallory asked.
"Surely."
"Fellow had a bump on his forehead, right here?"
"Dammy if he didn't."
"That was Captain Swing," Mallory said.
"Then I'm a chuckle-headed fool," Brian cried. "Didn't seem right to shoot a man in the back, but if I'd knowed it was him, I'd have blowed his lumpy headpiece off."
"Dr. Edward Mallory," a voice cried from the darkened floor below.
Mallory rose, peered around a bale. The Marquis of Hastings stood below them, his head bandaged and a lantern in one hand. He waved a white kerchief on a stick.
"Leviathan Mallory, a parley with you," the Marquis shouted.
"Speak up, then," Mallory said, careful not to show his head.
"You're trapped here, Dr. Mallory, but we've an offer for you. If you'll tell us where you've hidden a certain object of value which you stole, then we'll let you and your brothers go free. But your police spy from the Special Bureau must stay. We have questions for him."
Mallory laughed him to scorn.
"Hear me, Hastings, and all the rest of you. Send us that maniac Swing and his murdering tart with their hands bound. Then we'll let the rest of you creep out of here before the army comes." "A show of insolence avails you nothing," the Marquis said. "We shall fire that cotton, and you'll roast like a brace of rabbits."
Mallory turned. "Can he do that?"
"Cotton won't burn worth a hang when it's packed tight as this," Brian theorized. "Surely, burn it," Mallory shouted. "Burn down the whole go down, and smother to death in the smoke." "You've been very bold, Dr. Mallory, and very lucky. But our choicest men patrol the streets of Limehouse now, liquidating the police. Soon they shall return, hardened soldiers, veterans of Manhattan. They'll take your little hideaway by storm, at the point of the bayonet. Come out now, while you've yet a chance to live."
"We fear no Yankee rabble. Bring 'em on for a taste of grape shot."
"We've made our offer. Reason it through like a proper savant."
"Go to hell," Mallory said.
"Send me Swing. I want to talk to Swing. I've had my fill of you, you poncy little traitor."
The Marquis retreated. After some moments, a desultory firing began. Mallory expended half a box of cartridges, returning fire at the muzzle flashes.
The anarchists then commenced the painful work of advancing a siege engine. It was an improvised phalanx of three heavy dolly carts, their fronts lashed with a sloping armor of marbled tabletops. The rolling armor was too wide to fit down the crooked alley to the cotton bales, so the rebels dug their way through the heaps of goods, piling them up by the flanks of the freight dollies. Mallory wounded two of them at their work, but they grew wiser with experience, and soon had erected a covered walkway behind the advancing siege works. There seemed to be far more men in the warehouse now. It had grown darker yet, but lantern light showed here and there, and the iron beams were full of snipers. There was loud talk, argument it seemed, to add to the groans of the wounded. The siege works crept closer yet. They were now below Mallory's best line of fire. If he exposed himself in an attempt to lean over the ramparts, without doubt the snipers would hit him. The siege works reached the base of the cotton bales. There was a sound of shredding at the base of the wall. A warped and muffled voice, assisted perhaps by a megaphone, sounded from within the siege works. "Dr. Mallory?" "Yes?" "You asked for me. Here I am. We are toppling the wall of your palace, Dr. Mallory. Soon you will be quite exposed." "Hard work for a professional gambler, Captain Swing. Don't blister your delicate hands." Tom and Fraser, who had been working in tandem, toppled a heavy cotton bale onto the siege works. It bounced off harmlessly. Well-concerted fire raked the fortress, sending the defenders diving for cover. "Cease fire!" Swing shouted and laughed. "Have a care, Swing. If you shoot me, you'll never learn where the modus is hidden." "Still the blustering fool. You stole the modus from us at the Derby. You might have returned it to us and spared yourself certain destruction. You stubborn ignoramus, you don't even have a notion of the thing's true purpose. It belongs by right to the Queen of Engines, and I know that well enough." "If you think that, you know nothing." "I know it is Ada's, for she told me so, and she knows where it is hidden, for I told her where I keep it."
"Liar!"
Swing shouted. "If Ada knew, we would have it already. She is one of us." Tom groaned aloud. "You are her tormentors, Swing."
"I tell you, Ada is ours.
The daughter of Byron would never betray the realm."
"Byron's dead,"
Swing cried, with the terrible conviction of truth. "And all that he built, all that you believe in, will now be swept away. You're dreaming." There was a long silence. Then Swing spoke again, in a new and coaxing voice.
"The army now fires upon the people, Dr. Mallory."
Mallory said nothing.
"The British army, the very bulwark of your so-called civilization, now shoots your fellow citizens dead in the streets. Men and women with stones in their hands are being murdered with rapid-fire weapons. Can you not hear it?"
Mallory made no reply.
"You have built on sand, Dr. Mallory. The tree of your prosperity is rooted in dark murder. The masses can endure you no longer. Blood cries out from the seven cursed streets of Babylondon." "Come out, Swing," Mallory cried. "Come out of your darkness. Let me see your face."
"Not likely," Swing said. There was another silence.
"I intended to take you alive, Dr. Mallory," Swing said in a voice of finality. "But if you have truly confessed your secret to Ada Byron, then I have no more need of you. My trusted comrade, my life's companion, she holds the Queen of Engines in a perfect net. We shall have Lady Ada and the modus, and futurity as well. And you shall have the depths of the poisoned Thames for your sepulchre."
"Kill us, then, and stop your damned blather!"
Fraser shouted suddenly, stung beyond endurance. Special Branch will see you kicking at a rope's end if it takes 100 years.
The voice of authority, Swing taunted. The almighty British government. You're fine at mowing down poor wretches in the street, but let us see your bloated plutocrats take this warehouse when we hold merchandise worth millions hostage here.
You must be completely mad, Mallory said. Why do you suppose I chose this place as my headquarters? You are governed by shopkeepers who value their precious goods more than any number of human lives. They will never fire on their own warehouses, their own shipping. We are impregnable here.
Mallory laughed. You utter jolterhead. If Byron's dead, then the government is in the hands of Lord Babbage and his emergency committees. Babbage is a master pragmatist. He'll not be stayed by concern for any amount of merchandise. Babbage is the pawn of the capitalists. He's a visionary, you deluded little clown. Once he learns you're in here, he'll blast this place into the heavens without a second thought.
Thunder shook the building. There was a pattering against the roof.
It's raining, Tom cried.
It's artillery, Brian said.
No, listen. It's raining, Brian. The stink is over. It's blessed rain.
An argument had broken out beneath the shelter of the siege works. Swing was snarling at his men. Cool water began dripping through the ragged fretwork of bullet holes in the roof.
It's rain, Mallory said, and licked his hand. Rain! We've won, lads!
Thunder rolled.
Even if they kill us here, Mallory shouted, it's over for them! When London's air is sweet again, they'll have no place to hide.
It may be raining, Brian said, but those are 10-inch naval guns, off the river.
A shell tore through the roof in a torrent of blazing shrapnel. They've got our range now, Brian shouted. For God's sake, take cover!
He began to struggle desperately with the cotton bales. Mallory watched in astonishment as shell after shell punched through the roof, the holes as neatly spaced as the stabs of a shoemaker's awl. Whirlwinds of blazing rubbish flew, like the impact of iron comets. The glass vaulting burst into 1,000 knife-edged shards. Brian was screaming at Mallory, his voice utterly drowned by the cacophony. After a stunned moment, Mallory bent to help his brother, heaving up another cotton bale and crouching within the trench. He sat there, the rifle across his knees. Blasts of light sheeted across the buckling roof. Iron beams began to twist under pressure, their rivets popping like gunshots. The noise was hellish, supernatural. The warehouse shook like a sheet of beaten tin. Brian, Tom, and Fraser crouched like praying Bedouins, their hands clamped to their ears. Bits of flaming wood and fabric fell gently onto the bales around them, jumping a bit with each repeated concussion, smoldering into the cotton where they lay. The warehouse billowed with air and heat. Mallory absently plucked 2 wads of cotton and stuffed them into his ears. A section of roofing collapsed quite slowly, like the wing of a dying swan. Rain in torrents fought the fires below. Beauty entered Mallory's soul. He stood, the rifle like a wand in his hands. The shelling had stopped, but the noise was incessant, for the building was on fire. Tongues of dirty flame leapt up in 100 places, twisted fantastically by gusts of wind. Mallory stepped to the edge of the cotton parapet. The shelling had knocked the covered walkway into fragments, like a muddy crawlway of termites crushed by a boot. Mallory stood, his head filled with the monotone roaring of absolute sublimity, and watched as his enemies fled screaming. A man stopped amid the flames and turned. It was Swing. He gazed up at Mallory where he stood, his face twisted with a desperate awe. He screamed something, screamed it louder still, but he was a little man, far away, and Mallory could not hear him. Mallory slowly shook his head. Swing raised his weapon then. Mallory saw, with a glow of pleased surprise, the familiar outlines of a Cutts Maudsley carbine. Swing aimed the weapon, braced himself, and pulled the trigger.
Presently, tenuous singing sounds surrounded Mallory, with a musical popping from the perforating roof behind him. Mallory, his hands moving with superb and unintentioned grace, raised his rifle, sighted, fired. Swing spun and fell sprawling. The Cutts Maudsley, still in his grasp, continued its spring-driven jerking and clicking, even after its drum of cartridges was empty. Mallory watched with tepid interest as Fraser, leaping through the wreckage with a spidery agility, approached the fallen anarchist with his pistol drawn. He handcuffed Swing, then lifted him limply over one shoulder. Mallory's eyes smarted. Smoke from the flaming warehouse was gathering under the wreckage of its roof. He looked down, blinking, to see Tom lowering a limping Brian to the floor. The two joined Fraser, who beckoned sharply. Mallory smiled, descended, followed. The three then fled through the whipping, thickening fires, with Mallory strolling after them. Catastrophe had knocked Swing's fortress open in a geyser of shattered brick dominoes. Mallory, blissful, the nails of his broken shoe heel grating, walked into a London reborn, into a tempest of cleansing rain. On April 12, 1908, at the age of 83, Edward Mallory died at his house in Cambridge. The exact circumstances of his death are obscured, steps having apparently been taken to preserve the proprieties incumbent on the decease of a former president of the Royal Society. The notes of Dr. George Sands, Lord Mallory's friend and personal physician, indicate that the great savant died of a cerebral hemorrhage. Sands also noted, apparently for purposes of his own, that the deceased had seemingly taken to his deathbed while wearing a patent set of elasticated underwear, socks with braces, and fully laced leather dress shoes. The doctor, a thorough man, also noted an item discovered beneath the deceased's flowing white beard. About the great man's neck, on a fine steel chain, was strung an antique lady's signet ring, which bore the crest of the Byron family and the motto, Crede Byron. The doctor's ciphered note is the only known evidence of this apparent bequest, possibly a token of appreciation. Very probably, Sands confiscated the ring, though a thorough catalogue of Sands' possessions, made after his own death in 1940, makes no mention of it. There is no mention of any such ring in the Mallory will, a very elaborate document of otherwise impeccable specificity. Envision Edward Mallory in the scholarly office of his palatial Cambridge home. It is late. The great paleontologist, his field days long behind him and his presidency resigned, now devotes the winter of his life to matters of theory and to the subtler outreaches of scientific administration. Lord Mallory has long since modified the radical catastrophist doctrines of his youth, gracefully abandoning the discredited notion that the Earth is no more than 300,000 years old, radioactive dating having proven otherwise. It is enough for Mallory that catastrophism proved a fortunate road to higher geological truth, leading him to his greatest personal triumph, the discovery, in 1865, of continental drift. More than the Brontosaurus, more than the Ceratopsian eggs of the Gobi Desert, it is this astonishing leap of reckless insight that has assured his immortal fame. Mallory, who sleeps little, seats himself at a curvilinear Japanese desk of artificial ivory. Past the open curtains, incandescent bulbs gleam beyond the polychrome, abstractly patterned windows of his nearest neighbor. The neighbor's house, like Mallory's own, is a meticulously orchestrated riot of organic forms, roofed with iridescent ceramic dragon scales, England's dominant style of modern architecture, though the mode itself has its turn-of-the-century origins in the thriving Republic of Catalonia. Mallory has only recently dismissed a purportedly clandestine meeting of the Society of Light. As the final hierarch of this dwindling confraternity, tonight he wears the formal robes of office. His woolen chasuble of royal indigo is fringed in scarlet. A floor-length indigo skirt of artificial silk, similarly fringed, is decorated with concentric bands of semi-precious stones. He has set aside a domed crown of beaded gold plate, with a neck guard of overlapping gilt scales. This rests now upon a small desk printer. He dons his spectacles, loads a pipe, fires it. His secretary, Cleveland, is a most punctilious and orderly man, and has left him two sets of documents, neatly squared atop the desk in folders of brass-clasped manila. One folder lies to his right, the other to his left, and it cannot be known which he will choose. He chooses the folder to his left. It is an engine-printed report from an elderly officer of the Mirokusha, a famous confraternity of Japanese scholars, which serves, not incidentally, as the foremost Oriental chapter of the Society of Light. The precise text of the report cannot be found in England, but is preserved in Nagasaki, along with an annotation indicating that it was wired to the hierarch via standard channels on April 11th. The text indicates that the Mirokusha, suffering a grave decline in membership and a growing lack of attendance, have voted to indefinitely postpone further meetings. It is accompanied by an itemized bill for refreshments and rental fees for a small upstairs room in the Seiyoken, a restaurant in the Tsukiji quarter of Tokyo. Lord Mallory, though this news is not unexpected, is filled with a sense of loss and bitterness. His temper, fierce at the best of times, has sharpened with old age. His indignation swells to helpless rage. An artery fails. That chain of events does not occur. He chooses the folder to his right. It is thicker than the one to his left, and this intrigues him. It contains a detailed field report from a Royal Society paleontological expedition to the Pacific coast of Western Canada. Pleased by an awakened nostalgia for his own expedition days, he studies the report closely. The modern labor of science can scarcely be more different from that of his own day. The British scientists have flown to the mainland from the flourishing metropolis of Victoria, and have motored at their ease into the mountains from a luxurious base in the coastal village of Vancouver. Their leader, if he can be given this title, is a young Cambridge graduate named Morris, whom Mallory remembers as a queer, ringleted fellow, given to wearing velvet capes and elaborate modernist hats. The strata under examination are Cambrian, dark shale of a near lithographic quality. And, it seems, they teem with a variety of intricate forms, the paper-thin and thoroughly crushed remnants of an ancient invertebrate fauna. Mallory, a vertebrate specialist, begins to lose interest. He has seen, he thinks, more trilobites than anyone ever should have to, and in truth he has always found it difficult to conjure up enthusiasm for anything less than 2 inches in length. Worse yet, the report's prose strikes him as unscientific, marked by a most untoward air of radical enthusiasm. He turns to the plates. There is a thing in the first plate that possesses 5 eyes. It has a long clawed nozzle instead of a mouth. There is a legless ray-like thing, all lobes and jelly, with a flat, fanged mouth that does not bite, but irises shut. There is a thing whose legs are 14 horny, pointed spikes, a thing which has no head, no eyes, no gut, but does have 7 tiny, pincered mouths, each at the tip of a flexible tentacle. These things bear no relation to any known creature, from any known period whatever. A rush of blood and wonder mounts within Mallory's skull. A vortex of implications begins to sort itself within him, mounting step by step to a strange and numinous glow, an ecstatic rush toward utter comprehension, ever brighter, ever clearer, ever closer. His head strikes the table as he slumps forward. He sprawls upon his back at the foot of the chair, limbs numb and airy, still soaring, wrapped within the light of marvel, the light of an awesome knowledge, pushing, pushing at the borders of the real, a knowledge that is dying to be born. 5th iteration, the all-seeing eye. An afternoon in Horse Ferry Road, 12th of November, 1855. Image recorded by A.G.S. Hullcoop of the Department of Criminal Anthropometry. The shutter of Hull Coop's Talbot Excelsior has captured 11 men descending the broad steps from the entrance of the Central Statistics Bureau. Triangulation locates Hull Coop, with his powerful lens, concealed atop the roof of a publisher's offices in Hollywell Street. Foremost among the 11 is Lawrence Oliphant. His gaze, beneath the black brim of his top hat, is mild and ironical. The tall, dull-surfaced hats create a repeated vertical motif common to images of the period. Like the others, Oliphant wears a dark frock coat above narrow trousers of a lighter hue. His neck is wrapped in a high choker of dark silk. The effect is dignified and columnar, though something in Oliphant's manner manages to suggest the sportsman's lounging stroll. The other men are barristers, bureau functionaries, a senior representative of the Colgate Works. Behind them, above Horse Ferry Road, swoop the tarred copper cables of the bureau's telegraphs. Processes of resolution reveal the pale blurs dotting these lines to be pigeons. Though the afternoon is unseasonably bright, Oliphant, a frequent visitor to the bureau, is opening an umbrella. The top hat of the Colgate's representative displays an elongated comma of white pigeon dung. Oliphant sat alone in a small waiting room, which communicated by a glazed door with a surgery. The buff-colored walls were hung with colored diagrams depicting the ravages of hideous diseases. A bookcase was crammed with dingy medical volumes. There were carved wooden pews that might have come from a wrecked church, and a coal-dyed woolen drugget in the middle of the floor. He looked at a mahogany instrument case and a huge roll of lint occupying places of their own on the bookcase. Someone called his name. He saw a face through the panes of the surgery door, pallid, the bulging forehead plastered with drenched strands of dark hair. "Collins," he said, "Captain Swing." And other faces, legion, the faces of the vanished, names suppressed from memory. "Mr. Oliphant?" Dr. McNeil regarded him from the doorway. Vaguely embarrassed, Oliphant rose from his pew, automatically straightening his coat. "Are you entirely well, Mr. Oliphant? Your expression was most extraordinary just then." McNeil was slender and neatly bearded, with dark brown hair, his gray eyes so pale as to suggest transparency. "Yes, thank you, Dr. McNeil. And yourself?" "Very well, thank you." "Some remarkable symptoms are emerging, Mr. Oliphant, in the wake of recent events. I've one gentleman who was seated atop an omnibus, Regent Street, when that vehicle was struck broadside by a steam gurney traveling at an estimated 20 miles per hour. "Really, how dreadful." To Oliphant's horror, McNeil actually rubbed his long white hands together. "There was no evident physical trauma as a result of the collision. None. None whatever." He fixed Oliphant with that bright, nearly colorless gaze. "Subsequently, we have observed insomnia, incipient melancholia, minor amnesiac episodes, numerous symptoms customarily associated with latent hysteria." McNeil smiled, a quick rictus of triumph. "We have observed, Mr. Oliphant, a remarkably pure, that is to say, a clinical progression of railway spine." McNeil bowed Oliphant through the doorway, into a handsomely paneled room, which was sparsely furnished with ominous electromagnetic appliances. Oliphant removed his coat and waistcoat, arranging them upon a mahogany valet stand. "And your spells, Mr. Oliphant?" "None, thank you, since the last treatment." Was this true? It was difficult to say, really. "And your sleep has been undisturbed?" "I should say so, yes." "Any dreams of note? Waking visions?" "No." McNeil stared with his pale eyes. "Very well." Oliphant, feeling utterly foolish in his braces and starched shirt front, climbed upon McNeil's manipulation table, a curiously articulated piece of furniture that in equal parts resembled a chaise longue and a torturer's rack. The thing's various segments were upholstered in a stiff engine-patterned brocade, smooth and cold to the touch. Oliphant attempted to find a comfortable position. McNeil made this impossible, spinning one or another of several brass wheels.
"Do be still," McNeil said.
Oliphant closed his eyes.
"This fellow, Pocklington," McNeil said.
"I beg your pardon?"
Oliphant opened his eyes.
McNeil stood above him, positioning a coil of iron on an adjustable armature.
"Pocklington. He's attempting to take credit for the cessation of the Limehouse cholera."
"The name isn't familiar. A medical man?"
"Hardly. The fellow's a works engineer. He claims to have ended the cholera by the simple expedient of removing the handle from a municipal water pump."
McNeil was screwing a braided copper cable in place.
"I'm afraid I don't follow you."
"Little wonder, sir. The man's either a fool or the worst sort of charlatan. He's written in the Times that the cholera is nothing more than the result of contaminated water."
"Is that entirely unreasonable, do you think?"
"Utterly counter to enlightened medical theory."
McNeil set to work with a second length of copper. "This Pocklington, you see, is something of a favorite of Lord Babbage's. He was employed to remedy the ventilation troubles of the pneumatic trains."
Oliphant, detecting the envy in McNeil's tone, felt a slight and spiteful satisfaction. Babbage, speaking at Byron's state funeral, had regretted the fact that modern medicine remained more an art than a science. The speech, naturally, had been most widely published.
"Do close your eyes, please, in the event of a spark being discharged."
McNeil was pulling on a pair of great stiff leather gauntlets.
McNeil connected the copper cables to a massive voltaic cell. The room filled with the faint, eerie odor of electricity.
"Please try to relax, Mr. Oliphant, so as to facilitate the polar reversal."
Half Moon Street was illuminated by a massive web lamp, a fluted Corinthian column fueled by sewer gas. Like the rest of London's webs, it had remained unlit during the summer's emergency, for fear of leaks and explosions. Indeed, there had been at least a dozen pavement-ripping blasts, most attributed to the same fire damp that powered the web. Lord Babbage was an outspoken supporter of the web method. As a result, every schoolboy knew that the methane potential from a single cow was adequate for an average household's daily heating, lighting, and cooking requirements. He glanced up at the lamp as he neared his own Georgian facade. Its light was another apparent token of returning normalcy, but he took little comfort in tokens. The physical and more crudely social cataclysm was past now, certainly, but Byron's death had triggered successive waves of instability. Oliphant imagined them spreading out like ripples in a pond, overlapping with others that spread from more obscure points of impact, creating ominously unpredictable areas of turbulence. One such, certainly, was the business of Charles Egremont and the current Luddite witch hunt. Oliphant knew with absolute professional certainty that the Luddites were defunct. Despite the best efforts of a few manic anarchists, the London riots of the past summer had shown no coherent or organized political agenda. All reasonable aspirations of the working class had been successfully subsumed by the radicals. Byron, in his vigorous days, had tempered justice with a well-dramatized show of mercy. Those early Luddite leaders who had made their peace with the Rads were now the tidy, comfortably well-to-do leaders of respectable trades unions and craft guilds. Some were wealthy industrialists, though their peace of mind was severely perturbed by Egremont's systematic disinterment of old convictions. A second wave of Luddism had arisen in the turbulent 40s, aimed this time directly against the Rads, with a charter of popular rights and a desperate zest for violence. But it had crumbled in a welter of internecine treachery, and its boldest spirits, such as Walter Gerard, had met a distressingly public punishment. Today, such groups as the Manchester Hellcats, to which Michael Radley had belonged as a boy, were mere youth gangs, quite devoid of political purpose. Captain Swing's influence might still be felt occasionally in rural Ireland, or even in Scotland, but Oliphant attributed this to the Rads' agricultural policies,
which tended to lag behind their brilliance in industrial management. No, he thought, as Bligh opened the door at his approach. The spirit of Ned Ludd was scarcely abroad in the land, but what was one to make of Egremont and his furious campaign? Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Bligh.
He gave Bligh his top hat and umbrella. Cook has a cold joint, sir.
Very good. I'll dine in the study, thank you.
Feeling well, sir?
Yes, thank you.
Either McNeil's magnets or the devilishly uncomfortable manipulation table had set his back aching. McNeil had been recommended to him by Lady Brunel, Lord Brunel's spine being assumed to have suffered an inordinate amount of railway shock in the course of his famous career. Dr. McNeil had recently diagnosed Oliphant's numinous spells, as he insisted on calling them, as symptoms of railway spine, a condition in which the magnetic polarity of the patient's vertebrae was assumed to have been reversed by trauma. It was McNeil's thesis that this condition might be corrected by the application of electromagnetism, and to this end, Oliphant now paid weekly visits to the Scots' Harley Street premises. McNeil's manipulations reminded Oliphant of his own father's unhealthily keen interest in mesmerism. Oliphant Sr., having served as Attorney General of the Cape Colony, had subsequently been appointed Chief Justice of Ceylon. Consequently, Oliphant had received a private and necessarily rather fragmentary education, one to which he owed both his fluency in modern languages and his extraordinary ignorance of Greek and Latin. His parents had been evangelicals of a markedly eccentric sort, and though he himself retained, however privately, certain aspects of their faith, he recalled with an odd dread his father's experiments, iron wands, spheres of crystal. And how, he wondered, climbing the carpeted stairs, would Lady Brunel be adjusting to life as the Prime Minister's wife? His Japanese wound began to throb as he gripped the banister. Taking out a triple-splined Maudsley key from his waistcoat pocket, he unlocked the door to his study. Bligh, who held the key's only duplicate, had lit the gas and banked the coals. The study, paneled in oak, overlooked the park from a shallow triple bay. An ancient refectory table, quite plain, running very nearly the length of the room, served as Oliphant's desk. A very modern office chair, mounted on glass-wheeled patent casters, regularly migrated around the table as Oliphant's work took him from one stack of folders to the next, then back again. The casters, in the chair's daily peregrinations, had begun to wear away the nap of the blue Axminster. 3 Colton Maxwell receiving telegraphs, domed in glass, dominated the end of the table nearest the window, their tapes coiling into wire baskets arranged on the carpet. There was a spring-driven transmitter as well, and an encrypting tape cutter of recent Whitehall issue. The various cables for these devices, in tightly woven sleeves of burgundy silk, snaked up to a floral eyebolt suspended from the central lavalier, where they then swung to a polished brass plate bearing the insignia of the post office, which was set into the wainscoting. One of the receivers began immediately to hammer away. He walked the length of the table and read the message as it emerged from the machine's mahogany base. Very busy with particulate fouling, but yes, do visit. Stop, Wakefield. End it. Bligh entered with a tray of sliced mutton and pickle. I brought a bottle of ale, sir, he said, setting out linen and silverware on a section of the table kept cleared for this purpose. Thank you, Bligh. Oliphant raised the tape of Wakefield's message with his fingertip, then let it droop back toward its wire basket. Bligh poured the ale, then departed with his tray and the empty ceramic bottle. Oliphant trundled the office chair around the table and sat down to spread his mutton with Branston pickle. He was startled from his solitary meal by the clatter of one of his 3 receivers. He glanced down the table and saw the tape beginning to unspool in the machine to the right. The machine to the left, on which Wakefield's invitation to lunch had arrived, was on his personal number. Right meant police business of some kind, likely Betteridge or Fraser. Putting down knife and fork, he rose. He watched the message emerge from its brass slot. Ray F.B., you are requested at once. Stop. Fraser. End it. He took his father's German Hunter from his waistcoat to note the time. Tucking it away, he touched the glass that domed the centermost of the three receiving telegraphs. There had been no message on that one since the death of the late Prime Minister. The address to which the cab carried him was in Brigsome's Terrace, off a thoroughfare of the sort that speculative builders delighted in carving through the ancient and still largely unexplored wilderness that was East London. The terrace itself, Oliphant decided as he alighted from his hansom, was as dismal a block of buildings as had ever been composed of brick and mortar. The builder who had speculated on these 10 dreary prison houses, he thought, had likely hung himself behind the parlor door of some adjacent tavern before the hideous things were finished. The streets through which the cab had conveyed him had been those one seemed to traverse at times such as these, all those thoroughfares seemingly unknown today and the ordinary pedestrian. A thin rain was falling now, and Oliphant momentarily regretted not having accepted the waterproof that Bligh had offered at the door. The two men before number 5 wore long, drooping black cape-like articles of waxed Egyptian cotton, a recent innovation from New South Wales, Oliphant knew, much praised in the Crimea, and precisely the thing for concealing weapons of the sort that these two most certainly concealed. "Special Bureau," Oliphant said, briskly climbing past the guards. Abashed by his accent and manner, they let him pass. It would be necessary to report that to Fraser. He entered the house, finding himself in a parlor lit by a powerful carbide lantern, atop a tripod, its merciless white glare magnified by a concave round of polished tin. The parlor was furnished with scraps salvaged from the ruins of gentility. There was a cottage piano and a chiffonier several sizes too large for the room. The latter struck him as pathetically gorgeous, with its tarnished gilt moldings. A threadbare patch of Brussels carpet swarmed with roses and lilies amid a desert of colorless drugget. Knitted curtains shaded the windows overlooking Brigsome's Terrace. Beside the glass, two hanging wire baskets were festooned with plants of the cactus species, which grew in prickly and spider-like profusion. Oliphant noted an acrid stench, more penetrating than the reek of carbide. Betteridge emerged from the rear of the house. He wore a high-crowned derby hat that made him seem altogether American, so that he might easily have been mistaken for one of the Pinkerton operatives he shadowed daily. Likely the effect was deliberate, down to the patent boots with their elasticated side gores. His expression, quite uncharacteristically, was one of grave anxiety. "I'll take full responsibility, sir," he stammered. Something was very wrong. "Mr. Fraser's waiting for you, sir. Nothing's been moved." Oliphant allowed himself to be led through the doorway and up a narrow, perilously steep flight of stairs. They emerged in a barren hallway, illuminated by a second carbide lantern. Great spreading continents of nitre marred the bare plaster walls. The burnt smell was stronger here. Through another doorway, into yet brighter glare, and Fraser's dour face looking up from where he knelt beside a sprawled body. Fraser seemed about to speak. Oliphant silenced him with a gesture. Here, then, was the source of the reek. Upon an old-fashioned coaching case stood a compact modern Primus stove of the sort intended for camp, its brass fuel canister gleaming bright as a mirror. Upon its ring rested a pannikin of black cast iron. Whatever had been cooking in this vessel was now a charred and bitterly odorous residue. He turned his attention to the corpse. The man had been a giant. In the small room, it was necessary to step over his outspread limbs. Oliphant bent to study the contorted features, the death-dulled eyes. He straightened, facing Fraser. "And what do you make of this?" "He was warming tinned beans," Fraser said, "eating them straight out of the pot there. With this..." With the toe of his shoe, Fraser indicated a kitchen spoon of chipped blue enamel. "I'd say he was alone. I'd say he managed to choke down a good third of the tin before the poison felled him." This poison, Oliphant said, taking his cigar case and sterling cutter from his coat. What do you suppose it was? He extracted a cheroot, clipped and pierced it.
Something potent, Fraser said, by the look of him.
Yes, Oliphant agreed. Big chap. Sir, Betteridge said, you'd best see this. He displayed a very long knife, sheathed in sweat-stained leather. A sort of harness dangled from the sheath. The weapon's handle was of dull horn, its hilt of brass. Betteridge drew the thing from its sheath. It was something on the order of a sailor's dirk, though single-edged, with a peculiar reverse curve at the tip. "What is that bit of brass along the top?" Oliphant asked.
"To parry another man's blade," Fraser said. "Soft stuff. Catches the edge. American business."
"Maker's mark?"
"No, sir," Betteridge said. "Hand-forged by a smith, from the look of it."
"Show him the pistol," Fraser said.
Betteridge sheathed the knife, set it atop the coaching case. He produced a heavy revolver from beneath his coat. "Franco-Mexican," he said, sounding remarkably like a salesman. "Ballester Molina. Cocks itself automatically after the first shot."
Oliphant raised an eyebrow.
"Military issue."
The pistol was somewhat crude in appearance.
"Cheap stuff," Fraser said with a glance for Oliphant. "For the American war trade, evidently. The Metropolitans have been confiscating them from sailors. Too many of them about."
"Sailors?"
"Confederates, Yanks, Texians."
"Texians,"
Oliphant said, and tasted the end of his unlit cheroot. "I take it we agree in assuming our friend here is of that nationality? He'd a sort of nest in the garret reached by a trap door."
Betteridge was wrapping the pistol back into its oilcloth.
"Terribly cold, I imagine."
"Well, he'd blankets, sir."
"The tin."
"Sir?"
"The tin that contained the man's last meal, Betteridge."
"No, sir, no tin."
"Tidy," Oliphant said to Fraser. "She waited for the poison to do its work, then returned, removing the evidence."
"The surgeon will have our evidence out for us, never you fear," Fraser said.
Oliphant was overtaken by an abrupt nausea at Fraser's manner, at the proximity of the corpse, at the pervading stink of burnt beans. He turned and stepped out into the hallway, where another of Fraser's men was adjusting the carbide lantern. What a foul house this was, in a foul street, harboring the foulest sort of business. A wave of loathing overtook him, a fierce, hopeless detestation of the secret world, its midnight journeys, labyrinthine lies, its legions of the damned, the lost. His hands were trembling as he struck a lucifer to light his cheroot.
"Sir, the responsibility..."
Betteridge was at his elbow. "My friend at the corner of Chancery Lane hasn't given me such a good leaf as usual," Oliphant said, frowning at the tip of his cheroot. "One must be very careful how one chooses one's cigars."
"We've been over the place top to bottom, Mr. Oliphant. If she was living here, there's no trace of her."
"Really? And to whom does that handsome chiffonier downstairs belong? Who waters the cacti? Does one water cacti? Perhaps they reminded our Texian friend of his homeland."
He puffed resolutely on his cheroot and descended the stairs, with Betteridge on his heels like an anxious young setter. A prim-looking sort from criminal anthropometry was lost in thought in front of the piano, as though trying to recall a tune. Of the various articles carried in this gentleman's black case, Oliphant knew, the least unpleasant were the calibrated linen tapes employed in taking Bertillon measurements of the skull.
"Sir,"
Betteridge said, when the anthropometrist had moved upstairs. "If you feel I was responsible, sir, for losing her, I mean. I believe, Betteridge, that I dispatched you earlier to a matinee at the Garrick to report on the acrobatic ladies of Manhattan, did I not?"
"Yes, sir."
"You saw the Manhattan troupe, then?"
"Yes, sir."
"But, do let me suppose, you saw her there as well?"
"Yes, sir. And Mackerel and his two as well."
Oliphant removed his spectacles and polished them. "The acrobats, Betteridge. To attract such an audience, they must have been quite remarkable. Lord, sir, they batter one another with brickbats. The women run about in their dirty bare feet, and, well, scarves, sir, bits of gauze, no proper garments to speak of." "And you enjoyed yourself, Betteridge?" "Quite honestly, sir, no. Like a panto in Bedlam it was, and I'd the job of it with the Pinkers there." Mackerel was their name for the senior Pinkerton agent, a side-whiskered Philadelphian who most frequently presented himself as Beaufort Kingsley de Haven, though sometimes as Beaumont Alexander Stokes. He was Mackerel by virtue of his seemingly invariable choice of breakfast, as reported by Betteridge and the other watchers. Mackerel and two subordinates had been regular London fixtures for some 18 months now, and Oliphant found them remarkably interesting and a solid pretext for his own government funding. The Pinkerton organization, while ostensibly a private firm, served as the central intelligence-gathering organ of the embattled United States, with networks in place throughout the Confederate states, as well as in the republics of Texas and California. The Pinkertons were often privy to information of considerable strategic importance. With the arrival in London of Mackerel and his cohorts, certain voices in Special Branch had argued for the various classic modes of coercion. Oliphant had quickly moved to quash this suggestion, arguing that the Americans would be of inestimably greater value if they were allowed to operate freely. Under, he made it clear, the constant surveillance of both the Special Branch and his own Special Bureau of the Foreign Office. In practice, of course, the Special Bureau utterly lacked the manpower for any such undertaking, which had resulted in Special Branch assigning Betteridge to the task, along with a steady rota of nondescript Londoners, all of them experienced watchers, personally vetted by Oliphant. Betteridge reported directly to Oliphant, who assessed the raw material before passing it on to Special Branch. Oliphant found the arrangement thoroughly agreeable. Special Branch had so far refrained from comment. The movements of the Pinkertons had gradually revealed minor but hitherto unsuspected substrata of clandestine activity. The resultant information constituted a rather mixed bag, but this was all the more to Oliphant's liking. The Pinkertons, he had happily declared to Betteridge, would provide the equivalent of geological core samples. The Pinkertons would plumb the depths, and Britain would reap the benefits. Betteridge, almost immediately and to his considerable pride, had discovered that one Mr. Fuller, the Texian legation's sole and woefully overworked clerk, was in Pinkerton pay. In addition, Mackerel had demonstrated a profound curiosity about the affairs of General Sam Houston, going so far as to personally burglarize the country estate of the exiled Texian president. Some months subsequently, the Pinkertons had shadowed Michael Radley, Houston's flack, whose murder in Grand's Hotel had led directly to a number of Oliphant's current lines of inquiry. "And you saw our Mrs. Bartlett attending the Communard performance. You're entirely positive?"
"No question, sir."
"Mackerel and company were aware of her. She of them?"
"No, sir. They were watching the Communard panto, hooting and jeering. Mrs. Bartlett crept backstage between acts. She kept well in the rear afterwards. Applauding, though."
Betteridge frowned. "The Pinkertons made no attempt to follow Mrs. Bartlett?"
"No, sir."
"But you did?"
"Yes, sir. When the show was done, I left Boots and Becky Dean to ghost our chaps and set out to dog her alone."
"You were very foolish, Betteridge." Oliphant's tone was exceptionally mild. "You should rather have dispatched Boots and Becky. They are far more experienced, and a team is invariably more efficient than a single watcher. You might easily have lost her." Betteridge winced.
"Or she might have killed you, Betteridge. She's a murderess, quite appallingly accomplished, known to conceal vitriol about her person."
"Sir, I take full—" "No, Betteridge, no. None of it. She'd already killed our Texian Goliath. Highly premeditated, no doubt. She was in a position to provide him food, aiding and abetting him, just as she and her friends did during that night of terror at Grand's Hotel. She'd bring him round his tinned beans, you see. He depended on her. He'd gone to ground in a garret. Simply a matter of doctoring a tin.
But why should she turn on him now, sir?
A question of loyalties, Betteridge. Our Texian was a nationalist zealot. Patriots may league with the very devil in pursuit of a nation's interest, but there are matters at which they balk. Likely she demanded some deadly service from him, and he refused. He knew as much from the confession of Collins. The nameless Texian had been a fractious ally. The fellow crossed her, spurned her schemes, as did the late Professor Rudwick, so he met the same fate as the man he killed.
She must be desperate.
Perhaps, but we have no reason to believe you alerted her by following her here.
Betteridge blinked. Sir, when you sent me to see the communards, did you suspect she might be there?
Not at all. I confess, Betteridge, I was indulging a whim. Lord Engels, an acquaintance of mine, is fascinated by this fellow Marx, the commune's founder.
Engels, the textile magnate?
Yes. He's quite eccentric about it, actually. About those communard women, sir? About Mr. Marx's theories in general, and the fate of the Manhattan Commune in particular. Friedrich's generosity, in fact, made this current tour possible.
The richest man in Manchester funding that sort of tripe?
Betteridge seemed genuinely disturbed by the revelation. Peculiar, yes. Friedrich is himself the son of a wealthy Rhineland industrialist. In any case, I was curious for your report. And of course, I did rather expect our Mr. Mackerel to put in an appearance. The United States take the dimmest possible view of the Red Revolution in Manhattan.
One of the women gave a sort of, well, sermon, sir, before the panto, and ranted like 60. Some business about iron laws.
The iron law of history, yes. All very doctrinaire. But Marx has borrowed much of his theory from Lord Babbage. So much so that his doctrine may one day dominate America. Oliphant's nausea had passed. But consider, Betteridge, that the commune was founded during citywide anti-war riots, protesting the Union conscription. Marx and his followers seized power during a period of chaos, somewhat akin to last summer's affliction in London. Here, of course, we've come through in good form, and that in spite of having lost our great orator in the very midst of the emergency. Proper succession of power is everything, Betteridge.
Yes, sir, Betteridge nodded, distracted from the matter of Lord Engel's communard sympathies by Oliphant's patriotic sentiments.
Oliphant, suppressing a sigh, rather wished that he himself believed them. Oliphant nodded and napped on the journey home. He dreamed, as he often did, of an omniscient eye in whose infinite perspectives might be sorted every least mystery. Upon arrival, he found, to his ill-concealed chagrin, that Bly had drawn a bath for him in the collapsible rubber tub recently prescribed by Dr. McNeil. In robe and nightshirt, slippered in embroidered moleskin, Oliphant examined the thing with resigned distaste. It stood steaming before the perfectly good and perfectly empty tub of white porcelain which dominated his bathroom. It was Swiss, the rubber bath, its slack black trough gone taut and bulbous with the volume of water it presently contained. Supported by an elaborately hinged frame of black enameled teak, it was connected to the geyser with a worm-like hose and several ceramic petcocks. Removing his robe and then his nightshirt, he stepped from his slippers, then from the chill of octagonal marble tiles, into the soft, warm maw. It very nearly overturned as he struggled to sit. The elastic material, supported on all sides by the frame, gave distressingly beneath one's feet, and was, he discovered, quite horrid in its embrace of one's buttocks. He was, according to McNeil's prescription, to recline for a quarter hour, his head supported on the small pneumatic pillow of rubberized canvas supplied for this purpose by the manufacturer. McNeil maintained that the cast-iron body of a porcelain tub confused the spine's natural attempts to return to its correct magnetic polarity. Oliphant shifted slightly, grimacing at the obscene sensation of the clinging rubber. Bly had arranged a sponge, pumice, and a fresh bar of French milled soap in the little bamboo basket attached to the side of the tub. Bamboo, Oliphant supposed, must also lack magnetic properties. He groaned, then took up sponge and soap and began to wash himself. Released from the pressing business of the day, Oliphant, as he often did, undertook a detailed and systematic act of recollection. He had a natural gift for memory, greatly aided in youth by the educational doctrines of his father, whose ardent interest in mesmerism and the tricks of stage magic had introduced his son to the arcane disciplines of mnemonics. Such accomplishments had been of great use to Oliphant in later life, and he practiced them now with a regularity he had once devoted to prayer. Almost a year had passed since his search through the effects of Michael Radley in room 37, Grand's Hotel. Radley had owned a modern steamer trunk of the sort that, upended and opened, served as a compact combination of wardrobe and bureau. This, along with a scuffed leather hat case and a brass-framed jacquard satchel, constituted the whole of the publicist's luggage. Oliphant had found the intricacy of the trunk's fittings depressing. All these hinges, runners, hooks, nickeled catches, and leather tabs. They spoke of a dead man's anticipation of journeys that were never to be. Equally pathetic were the three gross of fancily stippled carte de visite, with Radley's Manchester telegraph number arranged in the French manner, still wrapped in printer's tissue. He began by unpacking each section in turn, laying Radley's clothing out on the hotel bed with a valet's precision. The publicist had entertained a fondness for silk nightshirts. As he worked, Oliphant examined maker's labels and laundry marks, turning out pockets and running his fingers over seams and linings. Radley's toilet articles were secured in a removable envelope of waterproofed silk. Oliphant examined the contents, handling each object in turn. A badger shaving brush, a self-stropping safety razor, a toothbrush, a tin of tooth powder, a sponge bag. He wrapped the ivory handle of the brush against the foot of the bedstead. He opened the razor's leatherette case. Nickel plate gleamed against a bed of violet velour. He emptied the tooth powder out on a sheet of Grand's engraved stationery. He looked in the sponge bag and found a sponge. The glitter of the razor drew his eye. Dumping its various components atop the starched bib of an evening shirt, he used the penknife on his watch chain to pry the fitted velour nest from the case. It came away easily, revealing a tightly folded sheet of foolscap. Upon this sheet, in pencil, quite smudged with frequent erasure and re-erasure, was written what appeared to be the start of a draft letter. Undated, lacking any term of address, it was unsigned. I trust you recall our two conversations of the past August, during second of which you so kindly entrusted me with your conjectures. I am pleased to inform you that certain manipulations have yielded a version, a true version of your original, which I feel most confidently can at last be run, thereby demonstrating that proof, so long sought and expected. The remainder of the sheet was blank, with the exception of three faintly penciled rectangles containing the Roman capitals ALG, COMP, and MOD. Alg, Comp, and Mod had subsequently become a fabulous three-headed beast, frequent visitor to the higher fields of Oliphant's imagination. His discovery of the probable meaning of this cipher, while examining transcripts of the interrogation of William Collins, had failed to dispel the image. Alg Comp Mod was with him still, a serpent-necked chimera, its heads nastily human. Radley's face was there, quite dead, mouth agape, eyes blank as fog, and the cool marble features of Lady Ada Byron, aloof and impassive, framed by curls and ringlets that were proofs of a pure geometry. But the third head, sinuously swaying, evaded Oliphant's gaze. He sometimes imagined its face was Edward Mallory's, resolutely ambitious, hopelessly frank. At other times he took it to be the pretty, poisonous visage of Florence Bartlett, wreathed in fumes of vitriol. And sometimes, particularly as now, in the rubber bat's cloying embrace, drifting toward the continent of sleep. The face was his own, its eyes filled with a dread he could not name. The following morning, Oliphant slept in, then kept to his bed, Bly supplying him with files from the study, strong tea, and anchovy toast. He read a Foreign Office dossier on one Wilhelm Stieber, a Prussian agent posing as an émigré newspaper editor named Schmidt. With considerably more interest, he read and annotated a Bow Street file detailing several recent attempts to smuggle munitions, each incident involving cargo destined for Manhattan. The next file consisted of engine-printed copies of several letters from a Mr. Copeland of Boston. Mr. Copeland, who traveled in lumber, was in British pay. His letters described the system of forts defending the island of Manhattan, with extensive notes on ordnance. Oliphant's gaze, from long practice, slid lightly over Copeland's account of the South Battery on Governor's Island, something of a relic by the sound of it, and quickly arrived at a report of rumors that the Commune had strung a chain of mines from the Romer Shoals to the Narrows. Oliphant sighed. He very much doubted that the channel had been mined, but the leaders of the Commune would certainly wish it to be thought to have been mined, as indeed it might soon be if the gentlemen of the Commission for Free Trade were to have their way. Bly was at the door. "You've an appointment with Mr. Wakefield, sir, at the Central Statistics Bureau." An hour later, Betteridge greeted him from the open door of a cab. "Good afternoon, Mr. Oliphant." Oliphant climbed in and settled himself. Pleated shades of black-proofed canvas were drawn firmly across either window, shutting out Half Moon Street and the stark November sun. As the driver urged the cab horse forward, Betteridge opened a case at his feet, took out a lamp, which he lit in a rapid and dexterous fashion, and fixed with a brass apparatus of screws and bolts to the arm of the seat. The interior of the case glittered like a miniature arsenal. He passed Oliphant a crimson file folder. Oliphant opened the file, which detailed the circumstances of the death of Michael Radley. He had himself been in the smoking room with the general and poor doomed Radley, the both of them awash with drink. Of their respective styles of drunkenness, Radley's had been the more presentable, the least predictable, the more dangerous. Houston, in his cups, delighted in playing the barbarous American. Red-eyed, perspiring, foul-mouthed, he lounged with one great coarse boot propped muddily atop an ottoman. As Houston spoke and smoked and spat, roundly cursing Oliphant and Britain, he sullenly shaved curls from a bit of pine, periodically pausing to strop the jackknife on the edge of his boot sole. Radley, in contrast, had positively quivered with the liquor's stimulant effect, cheeks flushed and eyes flashing. Oliphant's visit had been intended deliberately to disturb Houston on the eve of his departure to France, but the display of ill-concealed mutual hostility evident between the general and his publicist had been quite unexpected. He had hoped to sow seeds of doubt with regard to the French tour. To this end, and primarily for Radley's benefit, he had managed to imply an exaggerated degree of cooperation on the parts of the intelligence services of Britain and France. Oliphant had suggested that Houston already possessed at least one powerful enemy among the Police des Châteaux, the bodyguard and secret personal agency of the Emperor Napoleon. While the Police des Châteaux were few in number, Oliphant insinuated, they were utterly without legal or constitutional restraint. Radley, at least, in spite of his condition, had obviously taken note of the implied threat. They had been interrupted by a page who brought a note for Radley. As the door opened to admit the man, Oliphant had glimpsed the anxious face of a young woman. Radley had stated, as he excused himself, that it was necessary that he speak briefly with a journalistic contact. Radley had returned to the smoking room some 10 minutes later. Oliphant then took his leave, having endured an extended and particularly florid tirade from the general, who had consumed the better part of a pint of brandy during Radley's absence. Summoned back to Grand's by telegram in the early hours of dawn, Oliphant had immediately sought out the hotel detective, A retired metropolitan named McQueen, who had been called to Houston's room, number 24, by the desk clerk, Mr. Parks. While Parks attempted to calm the hysterical wife of a Lancashire paving contractor, resident in number 25 at the time of the disturbance, McQueen had tried the knob of Houston's door, discovering it to be unlocked. Snow was blowing in through the demolished window, and the air, already chilled, stank of burnt gunpowder, blood, and, as McQueen delicately put it, the contents of the late gentleman's bowel. Spying the scarlet ruin that was Radley's corpse, all too visible in the cold light of dawn, McQueen had called to Parks to telegraph the Metropolitans. He then used his passkey to lock the door, lit a lamp, and blocked the view from the street with the remains of one of the window curtains. The condition of Radley's clothing indicated that the pockets had been gone through. Sundry personal objects lay in the pool of blood and other matter surrounding the corpse. A repeating match, a cigar case, coins of various denominations. Lamp in hand, the detective surveyed the room, discovering an ivory-handled Leacock and Hutchings pocket pistol. The weapon's trigger was missing. Three of its five barrels had been discharged, very recently, McQueen judged. Continuing his search, he had discovered the gaudy gilded head of General Houston's stick, awash in splintered glass. Nearby lay a bloodied packet, tightly wrapped in brown paper. It proved to contain 100 kinetrope cards, their intricate fretting of punch holes ruined by the passage of a pair of bullets. The bullets themselves, of soft lead and much distorted, fell into McQueen's palm as he examined the cards. Subsequent examination of the room by specialists from Central Statistics, the attention of the Metropolitan Police at Oliphant's request having been swiftly deflected from the matter, added little to what the veteran McQueen had observed. The trigger of the Leacock and Hutchings pepper box was recovered from beneath an armchair. A more peculiar discovery consisted of a square-cut white diamond of 15 carats and very high quality, which was found firmly wedged between two floorboards. Two men from criminal anthropometry, no more than usually cryptic about their purposes, employed large squares of tissue-thin adhesive grid paper to capture various hairs and bits of fluff from the carpet. They guarded these specimens jealously and took them away promptly, and nothing was ever heard of them again. "Are you done with that one, sir?" He looked up at Betteridge, then down at the file, seeing Radley's blood spread in a tacky pool. "We're in Horseferry Road, sir." The cab came to a halt. "Yes, thank you." He closed the file and handed it to Betteridge. He descended from the cab and mounted the broad stairs. Regardless of the circumstances surrounding a given visit, he invariably felt a peculiar quickening upon entering the Central Statistics Bureau. He felt it now, certainly, a sense of being observed somehow, of being known and numbered. The eye. Yes. As he spoke to the uniformed clerk at the visitor's desk, a gang of journeyman mechanics emerged from a hallway to his left. They wore engine-cut woolen jackets and polished brogues soled with crepe rubber. Each man carried a spotless tool satchel of thick white duck, cornered with bronze rivets and brown hide. As they moved toward him, conversing among themselves, some drew pipes and cheroots from their pockets, in anticipation of a ship's end smoke. Oliphant experienced a sharp pang of tobacco hunger. He had often had call to regret the Bureau's necessary policy regarding tobacco. He looked after the mechanics as they passed, out between the columns and the bronze sphinxes. Married men, assured of a Bureau pension, they would live in Camden Town, in New Cross, in any respectable suburb, and would furnish their tiny sitting rooms with papier-mâché sideboards and ornate Dutch clocks. Their wives would serve tea on gaudily japanned tin trays. Passing an irritatingly banal quasi-biblical bas relief, he made his way to the lift. As the attendant bowed him in, he was joined by a glum gentleman who was daubing with a handkerchief at a pale streak on the shoulder of his coat. The articulated bars of the brass cage rattled shut. The lift ascended. The gentleman with the soiled coat made his exit at the third stop. Oliphant rode on to the fifth, the home of quantitative criminology and non-linear analysis. While he found the latter infinitely more compelling than the former, it was QC he needed today, most particularly in the person of Andrew Wakefield, the departmental undersecretary. The clerks of QC were individually walled into neatly cramped cells of rolled steel, asbestos, and veneer. Wakefield presided over them from a grander version of the same scheme, his sparse, sandy head framed by the brass-fitted drawers of a multitude of card files. He glanced up as Oliphant approached, prominent front teeth displayed against his lower lip. "Mr. Oliphant, sir," he said, "a pleasure as ever. Pardon me." He shuffled a number of punch cards into a sturdy blue envelope lined with tissue paper and meticulously wound the little scarlet string about the two halves of the patent clasp. He set the envelope aside in an asbestos-lined hutch containing several other envelopes of identical hue. Oliphant smiled. "Fancy I can read your punch holes, Andrew." He levered a spring-loaded stenographer's chair up from its ingenious housing and took a seat, his furled umbrella balanced across his knees. "Know what a blue envelope's about, do you?" Springs clanged as Wakefield folded his articulated writing desk into its narrow slot. "Not a specific one, no, but I'd rather imagine that's the trick of it. There are men who can read cards, Oliphant, but even a junior clerk can read the directive primaries as easily as you read the keynotes in the underground." "I never read the keynotes in the underground, Andrew." Wakefield snorted. Oliphant knew this to be his equivalent of laughter. "And how are things among the corps diplomatique, Mr. Oliphant? Coping with our Luddite conspiracy, are we?" It would have been impossible to mistake the man's sarcasm, but Oliphant pretended to take him quite literally. "It really hasn't had too great an effect as yet, not among my own areas of special interest." Wakefield nodded, assuming that Oliphant's areas of special interest were limited to the activities of foreign nationals on British soil. On Oliphant's request, Wakefield regularly ordered the files spun on groups as diverse as the Carbonari, the Knights of the White Camellia, the Fenian Society, the Texas Rangers, the Greek Hetairai, the Pinkerton Detective Agency, and the Confederate Bureau of Scientific Research, all of whom were known to be operative in Britain. "I trust that the Texian material we provided has been of some use," Wakefield inquired, coil springs creaking behind him as he leaned forward. "Quite," Oliphant assured him. "You wouldn't know," Wakefield began, taking a gold-plated propelling pencil from his pocket, "if their legation intends a change of premises." He tapped the pencil against his front teeth, producing a loud clicking sound that Oliphant found repulsive. "From their present location in St. James's, round from Barry's the wine merchant?"
"Precisely."
Oliphant hesitated, seeming to weigh the matter. "I shouldn't think so. They haven't any money. I suppose it would depend upon the goodwill of the landlord, finally." Wakefield smiled, his teeth dimpling his lower lip. "Wakefield," Oliphant said, "do tell me. Who wishes to know?"
"Criminal anthropometry."
"Really? Are they involved in surveillant activities?"
"I gather it's technical, actually. Experimental."
Wakefield put his pencil away.
"Your savant chap. Mallory, was it?"
"Yes."
"Saw a review of his book. Off to China, is he?"
"Mongolia. Heading up an expedition for the Geographical Society." Wakefield pursed his lips and nodded.
"Out from underfoot, I should think."
"Out of harm's way, one should hope. Not a bad sort, really. Seemed to keenly appreciate the technical aspects of your bureau's work. But I've a technical matter for you myself, Andrew."
"Really?"
Wakefield's springs creaked. "Having to do with post office procedure." Wakefield made a small, entirely non-committal sound in his throat. Oliphant took an envelope from his pocket and passed it to the undersecretary. It was unsealed. Wakefield took a pair of white cotton gloves from a wire basket at his elbow, drew them on, extracted a white telegraphic address card from the envelope, glanced at it, then met Oliphant's gaze.
"Grand's Hotel," Wakefield said.
"Quite." The establishment's crest was printed on the card. Oliphant watched as Wakefield automatically ran a gloved fingertip across the lines of punch holes, checking for indications of wear that might cause mechanical difficulties.
"You wish to know who sent it?"
"That information is in my possession, thank you."
"Name of addressee?"
"I am aware of that as well." The springs creaked. Nervously, it seemed to Oliphant. Wakefield rose with a twanging of steel and carefully inserted the card in a brass slot set into the face of a glass-fronted instrument which overhung a bank of card files. With a glance at Oliphant, he reached up a gloved hand and cranked down an ebony-handled lever. On the downstroke, the device thumped like a shopman's credit press. As Wakefield released the lever, it began to slowly right itself, humming and clicking like a publican's wagering machine. Wakefield watched as the whirling character wheels ticked and slowed. Abruptly, the device was silent.
"Egremont," Wakefield read aloud but quietly. "The Beaches, Belgravia."
"Indeed." Oliphant watched as Wakefield extracted the card from the brass slot. "I require the text of that telegram, Andrew."
"Egremont," Wakefield said, as though he hadn't heard.
He took his seat again, replaced the card in its envelope, and removed his gloves. "He seems to be everywhere, our Right Honorable Charles Egremont. No end of work he's making for us here, Oliphant. The text of the message, Andrew, is here in the bureau. It exists physically, I believe, as however many inches of telegrapher's tape. Do you know I've 55 miles gear yardage under me, still fouled from the stink? Aside from the fact that your request is rather more than usually irregular. Usually irregular. That's rather good. And your friends from the special branch trooping in hourly, demanding that our brass be spun and spun again, in hope of shaking loose these Luddites alleged to be lodged in the nation's rafters. Who is this bloody man, Oliphant?" "A rather junior rad politician, I understand. Or was, till the stink and the resulting disorders. Till Byron's death, rather. But we've Lord Brunel now, haven't we?"
"Indeed, and bloody madness under him in Parliament."
Oliphant let the silence lengthen. "If you could obtain the text of the telegram, Andrew," he said at last, very quietly, "I should be very grateful."
"He's a very ambitious man, Oliphant, with ambitious friends."
"You are not alone in that assessment." Wakefield sighed.
"Under the circumstances, extreme discretion."
"By all means."
"Aside from which, our yardage is filthy. Condensed particulate matter. We're working the mechanics on triple shifts and having some success with Lord Colgate's aerosol applications, but I sometimes despair of ever having the system properly up and spinning."
He lowered his voice. "Do you know that the finer functions of the Napoleon have been unreliable for months?"
"The Emperor?"
Oliphant pretended to misunderstand.
"The Napoleon's gear yardage, in equivalent terms, is very nearly double ours," Wakefield said, "and it simply isn't functioning."
The thought seemed to fill him with a special horror.
"Had a stink of their own, have they?"
Wakefield grimly shook his head.
"There you are, then," said Oliphant. "Most likely the gears are jammed on a bit of onion skin."
Wakefield snorted. End of Side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.